Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show we talk to the director of the great new documentary One Night in Mill Street about the legendary boxing match between Chris Eubank and Steve Collins. We review Dev Patel's Monkey Man and the return of the Omen in the first Omen. That's what it's called. And performance psychologist Jerry Hussey chats about his favourite movie. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com with the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Good weekend to you all. I hope you're doing well. If you hear any nasalness or coughiness or chestiness, I'm just getting over a cold, so forgive me. I had a really bad dose, as they say, took to the bed on Easter Sunday. That's how bad I was, and I never go to bed. I'm not a napper. I can't go to bed and get up in the middle of the day. It just doesn't agree with me. I haven't done it in years, although my wife disagrees. But my memory is having not done it for a very long time. But I had to go to bed on Easter Sunday to recuperate from a terrible cold I appear to have. So I'm in the tail end of that. So hopefully you can't hear too much of that. And you can bear with whatever altered vocals I'm operating on this week. Lots of people in touch last week about the show when we looked at the best redemption movies. People agreeing mostly with our choices. Some people saying we didn't mention that, we didn't mention this, but you never can please all the people all the time. A couple of good suggestions though. The Old Oak, the great Ken Loach movie from last year. It's on Netflix. Great redemption story. Someone else suggested Dead Man's Shoes. Great movie as well. Paddy Considine. Also lots of other people still in touch about Three-Body Problem and enjoying the interviews with Liam Cunningham and Jonathan Pryce. Some people felt Jonathan Pryce was a little prickly. I didn't think so particularly. I like his style. But Three-Body Problem, people are enjoying it. Some people aren't. It's dividing people a bit on Netflix. I think it reaps rewards. Stick with it. I found it a very satisfying sci-fi series, I have to say. Now, this week on TV, I was watching this.
Okay, if you type in, Steve hasn't missed a step, because at his age, he only uses ramps.
We're on page 37 out of 117.
Look, we can do it any way you want. Obviously, to me, it seems like you go through the raw stuff, you put it in the script.
Yeah,
and
but
then
there's
we
so
go through
much, we're going to go through another 100 pages. Only thing that keeps Marty out of the Oscar in memoriam is no good films. There was not one person who was surprised at Marty's success. There were millions.
No.
Thanks to good diet and exercise, Marty outlived his career by 30 years.
It's not bad.
The unmistakable sound of Martin Short and Steve Martin there trading jokes for an upcoming show they're about to do. This is one of the many great scenes from Steve Martin, a documentary in two pieces, which landed last week on Apple TV. I caught up with it. It is very much two pieces because we have part one, which is Steve Martin growing up and essentially trying to become a successful stand-up comedian. And he tries for about 15 years, but by golly, by the end of it, does he become a successful stand-up comedian. He is huge, huge to the point of, I don't think anyone before or since has been as big as a stand-up comedian, to the point that he was playing like arenas. And I don't just mean, you know, the Three Arena, or I mean Nassau Coliseum on Long Island, which I think has 30,000 plus seats. Like, he was stadium filling comedian. And the funny thing is, as big a fan as I am of Steve Martin, his stand-up really doesn't blow me away. I have a pretty juvenile sense of humor, but I think even some of this is too juvenile for me. Now, that notwithstanding, I still think this is a great documentary because you saw his struggle to become a stand-up comedian, his somewhat unhappy childhood with a very distant and sometimes not pleasant father who certainly seemed to have his own issues and didn't support Steve the way he felt he should have. Steve started life working in Disneyland in a magic shop. It has a fascinating story. And then part two of it is kind of completely different. And then part one is kind of a traditional, you know, standard telling of a life or a part of a life. And then in part two, it takes us up to date with Steve Martin being interviewed, and Martin Short is in there a good bit, but it goes through his film career from the 80s on and how successful that was. Also, how occasionally he had a few flops, which he really didn't enjoy. It also gets into his kind of aloofness and his solitude, which he seemed to want for a lot of his life. And then it takes us right up to date where he gets married again later in life and has a child. And he looks back on his acting career with a lot of joy, some regret. There's a gorgeous scene in it where he talks about John Candy in Planes, Trains and Automobiles as he reads from a script, a deleted scenes. Absolutely beautiful. Some people are questioning, did it go far enough, that there's still some unanswered questions about what makes Steve Martin tick. My wife, who watched it with me, said the same thing. But I still think it was a hell of a documentary. It's just the footage that they have. The career this guy has had has been fascinating. To start out as a magician in Disneyland, to become a stadium filling comedian, then to become one of the most successful actors, comedic actors with occasional dramatic parts, then to, you know, have success in later life again with Only Murders in the Building and doing these banjo tours, because he's a brilliant banjo player, and doing tours with Martin Short. Fascinating guy, and the life is told really well in this. So a big thumbs up for me for Steve Martin, a documentary in two pieces, now on Apple TV. Now, you're listening to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn to the week's new cinema releases. Chief among them is the new Dev Patel directorial debut, Monkey Man, a kind of revenge thriller, and also a movie called The First Omen, which I thought was a movie from the 70s, but we will get to that in the company of film critic and arts journalist Chris Wasser, fresh from his hit appearance on the Best Redemption Movies. Chris, hello, how are you?
John, I'm very well, how are you?
Very well. So listen, Monkey Man, Dev Patel, his directorial debut, a pretty popular actor, I think it's fair to say. Now, we can't spend too long on it, but this had a very troubled and complicated passage to screen, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was thinking, if someone somewhere wants to back some riveting behind-the-scenes documentary about the making of Monkey Man, go for it, because I would happily watch that. Not that I'm taking pleasure in Dev Patel's hardships in terms of getting this film off the ground, but it's been a passion project of his for the best part of 10 years, since, you know, story conception up until release. And about 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, he got the green light. He was supposed to start shooting it at the beginning of 2020, but we all know what happened then. So the pandemic got in the way of him shooting on location in India, because the character's from India, the whole story takes place in India, but he couldn't do it. And look, I won't go into all the details, but he had to switch locations. They ended up filming on an Indonesian island instead of India. When they actually, you know, got a crew together and they did all their quarantine, they started shooting, he broke his hand during the first fight sequence. That's not ideal when you're playing an action man sort of role. You know, there were times where he ran out of money. He had a deal in place with Netflix. Then there was a question mark around that. But long story short, Jordan Peele came in at one stage and he watched an early version of this film, and he was just blown away. And he thought two things. One, I want to be involved. And two, this needs to be on the big screen. So it's thanks to Jordan Peele and his Monkey Paw Productions business at Universal that Dev Patel's directorial debut is getting a cinema release.
Oh, good man, Jordan. So my understanding of this, unfortunately, I haven't seen it, but I've read a bit about it. It's kind of, he's doing Charles Bronson to an extent. Like, this is a real out and out revenge thriller.
Oh, yeah. It's up there with the best of them. You know, it's one man in a nice suit against the world. And, you know, he has a devastating loss in his life and he wants to get revenge on the people that caused this. The story, it actually starts by explaining who and what Monkey Man is. And it starts in an underground fight club. And we see that Deb Patel's character, who's known only as Kid, he actually makes an unsatisfactory living as this illegal fighter on the underground scene. You know, you have Charlton Copley in there playing this really sleazy fight promoter who promotes these vicious fights where people like Kid, they're basically paid to take an awful beating. You know, fighters like him, they're not that great, they're not that clean, they're not great on the feet. They're paid to lose big. And he wears wears a monkey mask, a gorilla mask, while he's fighting. And so the crowd are always chanting for Monkey Man not to win, but to lose. And he's getting quite sick of this because he's not even getting the money that he's supposed to be getting, despite the fact that he's taking a vicious beating. But all of that has to be pushed aside because he somehow finds a way to get revenge on the people who killed his mother. And you might be thinking that's a bit of a plot swerve. And I thought the same when I was watching it. And it turns out that, you know, the story starts to explain itself a little bit. And it turns out that his background, he lost his mom when he was a kid. A crooked police officer was responsible for this. There was a fire. There was a raid on his village when he was a youngster. And a lot of people died, including his family. He's been, you know, he's kind of brought himself up. And he's always dreamed of a way of getting his own back. And to do that, he works his way into this, you know, the elite social scene in the city in India where he's from. And he gets a job first working for this powerful businesswoman. He targets where that crooked police officer who's now the police chief is going to be, and he tries to take his life, but obviously he's not ready for it, and it's a botched assassination attempt, and unfortunately he ends up being a fugitive. And that's where, you know, the real kind of redemption and the real kind of revenge story starts, because he goes from a messy, scrappy fighter who's trying to do everything himself to finding, you know, as a fugitive, a group of very powerful allies who train him and who bring out his inner champion, so that the next time he comes across this police officer, he's the real deal.
I'm thinking of Dev Patel's big performances in things like Slumdog Millionaire, Lion. He does do a strong line in overcoming adversity. It sounds like that's going on here as well.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a terrific actor. You know, obviously had his big break, came from Skins on E4 and Channel 4, had his big break in the cinema with Slumdog Millionaire. I think my favorite Dev Patel performance, it's probably the David Copperfield one that he did
was fantastic.
Yeah. Underappreciated as well. I'm not sure many people actually saw it when it came out, but that's The Green Knight. You've got Lion, for which he was awarded an Academy Award nomination. Really terrific actor. And I admire his confidence here and his ambition. That, you know, if there's a lot of actors who've decided to cast themselves in their directorial debuts, but not many would kind of maybe have survived all the hardships that were going on behind the scenes, but not many would do the things that Dev Patel does in this film. I mean, he takes some beating and he's doing an awful lot of stunts himself. You know, he's playing this action man who just has to go through the worst of it before he can get to the best. And it's quite a brave role to put yourself in, because, you know, John, not everyone can play the John Wick sort of character. And the reason I mentioned John Wick is because this film very early on mentions John Wick, and there's a joke about the kind of gun that kid is trying to buy. And I feel as though that was Dev Patel saying, yes, I'm aware that this is going to be almost like Dev Patel's John Wick, but, you know, there are other action movies. There are other action movies where, you know, the protagonist wears a nice suit. I think this is more to do with his love of Korean action films, you know, other action films outside of America, basically. And as I said, he is quite brave. He is quite confident. Does it pay off? I think it does. I mean, it is flawed, you know, and you would expect this for like a 2-hour film about a man trying to get his revenge. There's obviously going to be creases there. There's obviously going to be parts where the story kind of stumbles and trips, and it does go on a little bit, but that's okay. And I was thinking to myself, maybe this would be cleaner if a more experienced director was in charge. What would this have looked like if Dev Patel had just written it and maybe starred in it? But then it would lack all of those flaws, which actually create a bit of excitement and the enthusiasm that he has in directing this. I mean, it is messy, but it's just so determined to impress. And I don't think you would have had that with an experienced director.
Yeah. And you know, with a revenge thriller, you know, you always, you know, rightly or wrongly, you want to be satisfied. You want them to get revenge in some fashion, or she get revenge. And without giving a spoiler though, but is that wish satiated in this movie?
Yeah, I mean, there is a part of me that Kid is a more interesting character in the first half of this film, when he is quite scrappy and gangly and he hasn't really kind of, you know, perfected his martial arts skills. And we're hoping for the best, but we know he's going to end up in a bad situation before he can become the hero that he's supposed to be. And there's something about the way the second half of the film moves, when he does his training, when he finds his allies, and he becomes this, you know, almost unstoppable and virtually unkillable fighting machine, that he becomes a little bland, you know. And I realize that if you have a film you know, if you have a revenge story about a man who can't get his revenge because he never becomes that hero, then that wouldn't really work, would it? But at the same time, he is more interesting when he's flawed. And I did worry towards the end of this. I thought, do you have some sort of franchise in mind here? Because now that you're fully formed, or now that you're unstoppable, I mean, the sequels might be a little bit, but it might suffer the same fate as John Wick.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, look, it does what it needs to. As I said, it's a little bit baggy. It's probably a little bit too long. If some experienced heads had been involved in the beginning, that would have cleaned it up, but then it would lose its raw nature. And I think, you know, despite the fact that it is flawed, he has made a confident, capable and compelling action film.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So what are you going to say stars wise for Monkey Man?
I think 7 out of 10 would be fair.
Well, you're messing with the system. So what would that be on a 5-star review?
Oh, we're going back to 5. I apologize. Yeah. We're going back to 5. I'll tell you what, we'll go with 3.5 out of 5 then. We'll stick in the half for now, yeah.
Okay, man, you should have sent me a memo if you were going to mess with the system. 3.5, that sounds pretty good for Monkey Man. Let's take a quick clip.
When I was a boy, my mother used to tell me a story of a demon king and his army. They brought fire and terror to the land. They face the protector of the people, the white monkey.
There you are.
That is a clip from Monkey Man, starring Dev Patel and also directed by Dev Patel and written by Dev Patel as well, Chris, right?
Yes, it is. Yeah, he had some help with the screenplay, but he came up with the story initially.
I should say Monkey Man is in cinemas from this Friday, the 5th of April. Something very different is The First Omen. And by my calculation, this is, I think, the 6th iteration, if not the 7th, of The Omen. So where are we in The Omen franchise, Chris?
It's the 6th Omen film, John, but I agree. Didn't we already have a First Omen? You know, that name is...
It was just called The Omen.
It was. That name is a little bit clumsy, to be honest. No, this one takes place a year or two before the first film.
Okay.
So it is still set in the 1970s. And it occasionally...
I'm sorry, can I interrupt and say, if I had to, you know, my favorite horror movie of all time, it's a toss-up between The Exorcist and the First Omen movie. So I'm a massive fan of that movie. I enjoyed the second one. I actually liked the third one a lot. The John Moore remake, I never actually saw because I just couldn't bring myself to it. The other one, I didn't watch at all. So I do care deeply about this franchise, to say.
No, I care about the first one, certainly. It is a true original. The second one is not the worst. The third one, I can't believe you just admitted to being a fan of.
Yeah, Sam Neill, he got me.
Yeah, and look, John Moore, whatever he was doing, I think John Moore was trying to do what Gus Van Sant did on Psycho there. It was just let's just do an adaptation as though, you know, the same way people adapt plays, and he wanted to do it exactly the same way. But the big question was, why? There's no real need for it. But this one tries to do something a little bit different. And I know some people, I mean, look, I was put off of this before I even watched it, and I was put off by the tagline. I mean, it's not even a quote on the poster, John. It's a tagline, and it declares The First Omen to be the most terrifying movie of the year. And you're thinking to yourself, well, lads, that's a bit presumptuous, you know. Yeah. And also this, the idea that this horror franchise needs another installment. You know, we saw how disastrous things were with the Exorcist film and with the Exorcist sequel, Believer, last year. Mm-hmm. So I kind of went into this with my expectations low, and I came out thinking it's not a complete embarrassment. And I think part of that is the story is not the worst. So you have this young American woman, Margaret Dano. She's played by Nell Tiger-Free. She moves to Rome in 1971, and she believes that her future is with the church, and she is going to teach at an orphanage, and she is going to take her veil any day now. But all of these strange happenings begin to test her faith. So you have the other nuns at the orphanage. They begin to teach one or two, or they begin to act strangely around one or two of the kids. She starts seeing things that she really shouldn't. She's having these troubling visions. You have this frightened Irish priest, Father Brennan, who, you know, is in the original, but here is played by Ralph Ineson. He comes to her and he starts talking about this big conspiracy to bring about the birth of the Antichrist. And I think it only really hits home for poor Margaret after she witnesses a guy involved in a very grisly car accident that the priest, who is running around the place worried about the birth of the devil, might be onto something.
Okay, so this is then, because you were trying to explain where it sits in the franchise and I interrupted you. So this is kind of the origin story of Damien's mother.
I mean, is that a spoiler? I don't know if we've just spoiled the whole thing, but you know what? There's a part of me that doesn't really care.
It takes place before The First Omen, right?
It does. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, The First Omen. Yeah,
yeah. I think it likes to think that it's going to surprise you with those sort of revelations, but it's going to surprise nobody. It is quite silly and it is quite bloated. I mean, it's 2 hours long, and you better have something effective to hold the viewer's attention in a horror film now for 2 hours. And it does maybe sometimes rely on, you know, too many kind of cheap jump scares and all those sort of tactics that you'd see even in a film like The Nun, or any of those kind of Blumhouse horrors. But there are some genuinely unnerving thrills in here. And there are times where I did feel uncomfortable watching it, and that's what you want from a horror. And there are times where it tries to mimic and kind of imitate some of the freakier elements of the first Omen, of the original. And that's fine, because it does it in quite an effective way. So basically what I'm trying to say is there are parts of this that are surprisingly competent and that did scare me and that are quite effective. Unfortunately, there are also parts that stink. And there are, there are a lot of ineffective scares. Bill Nighy in there as this chatty, friendly clergyman. I don't know. It's potential. I love Bill Nighy, but that is potentially the worst piece of miscasting I've seen this year.
I was going to say it's very incongruous. I would have thought Bill Nighy showing up in a Omen movie.
Yeah, I mean, look, there are times where this film does try to have a sense of humor, but a Bill Nighy sense of humor is pushing it. You half expect him to, you know, do a little dance or wink at the camera every time he says something. And it kind of spoils it a little bit. And Ralph Ineson as Father Brennan, it's a bit too intense. There's a bit of a diddly eye about his Irish accent as well. So look, there are parts of it that don't really work. And it does fall into that Exorcist trap where it tries to stitch and attach itself to the original story, and it's all a bit clumsy. So what I'm saying, John, is I had very mixed feelings about this. You know, I was a little bit freaked out. I do admire the efforts in trying to tell some sort of story for an hour at least. And look, it is a little bit effective, but it has big problems. So I will say it's not as bad as any of those Exorcist films, but I'm still not convinced that we really need these sort of legacy prequels and legacy sequels.
Yeah, because that's very much what it is. And despite the fact that I've given a giant spoiler and you took me back from the precipice there, more or less, but it's pretty obvious. But I mean, without going into it, there is clearly a line from this one to the original 1976 yes. one. Yeah, okay. Okay,
yes, great. There is. Yeah, yeah. I would love to have known what, say, you know, what the late great Richard Donner would have made of it, because that original film, it doesn't rely on jump scares and it doesn't rely on anything else. It was so original, like every other first horror installment. I just think if we keep adding on to these franchises, we're forgetting to make new ones. You know,
absolutely.
There's enough prequels. There's enough sequels. I want to see new and original horror movies.
Absolutely. Write new stories. So what would you say stars-wise for The First Omen?
I'm going to be controversial and throw in another half star. I will give it 2.5 stars. And I will say, if you are going to go see it, just prepare, just lower your expectations and maybe approach with caution.
Okay. So that's 2.5 stars for the unfortunately named, I would suggest, The First Omen, which is definitively not the scariest movie of the year, according to Chris Wasser, who knows these things. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, John.
Up next, One Night in Mill Street. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, a movie releasing this Friday on the 5th of April is One Night in Mill Street, that tells the story of the amazing high-stakes prize fight in Mill Street, Cork, between the then reasonably unknown underdog Steve the Celtic Warrior Collins and the larger-than-life champion Chris, simply the best Eubank, an against-all-odds sporting event that gripped the entire nation. I think I was 20, remember being gripped by it. The documentary features interviews with Steve Collins and Chris Eubank, along with Irish boxing legend Barry McGuigan, Chris Eubank's former manager Barry Hearn, writer Paul Howard, and Tony Quinn, Steve Collins's, I think it's fair to say, controversial mind trainer. The film conjures up a time and place when the country was undergoing enormous social and economic change. It was directed by Andrew Gallimore, and the film won the Audience Award at the Cork International Film Festival and the Best Documentary Award at the Irish Film Festival in London. And I'm delighted to say Andrew joins me now. Hello, Andrew. How are you?
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having us.
So listen, Andrew, Mill Street, for an audience outside of Ireland, why was this rural place, Mill Street, chosen?
Well, the background to the story really is the night of Eurovision a year or so previously. And it's just to do with Noel Whelan watching Ireland win the Eurovision Song Contest, realizing that Ireland would need to stage it the following year. And he essentially hounded the powers that be into taking the Eurovision Song Contest to Mill Street. And then, you know, a very similar occurrence. He watches the press conference where Steve Collins gets this shot at the world title against Chris Eubank. And once again, he gets on the fax, as it was in those days, and starts bombarding the promoter of the fight with faxes, essentially offering Mill Street for nothing if Sky Sports wanted it as a venue. And that's how the fight got on Mill Street.
Yeah, because I remember the previous year, and no disrespect to the residents of Cork, but being a dirty dub, when the Eurovision was held in Mill Street, there was a collective, "Where's Mill Street?" So this guy, like, he deserves a huge amount of credit because he literally seemed to have got on the phone and, as you said, harangued people.
Well, yeah, I mean, Noel C. Duggan is an amazing kind of character. It's, he's still as energetic now as he was back in the days when he was harassing boxing promoters. Mill Street, I mean, I went to the fight and I took the Swansea Cork ferry, I remember it well, over to Cork, arrived at sort of around 7 o'clock in the morning or something and had to saunter around, you know, waiting for the hotel just to open up, let alone be able to get checked in. And being, you know, there's quite a few of us. I mean, I remember us walking around in sort of press laminates waiting to go to this fight. None of us having thought about, you know, where the venue was. We all expected basically to chuck our bags into the hotel and saunter off to the venue. And I remember just going for lunch somewhere and talking to the barman. He said, you know, you're up for the fight. I said, yeah. He said, why haven't you got going yet? And I said, well, you know, I'm here. And he said, well, the good news is you're in the right county. the bad news is you're not going to make the preliminary fights. And there was just a scramble, an absolute scramble in the city. People were sort of press passes trying to find taxis to take us out to Mill Street.
And then, just so people remember, Steve Collins, I mean, you know, these things get lost in the sands of time. It's been nearly 30 years at this stage, but he was very much the underdog. I mean, there was kind of a Rocky Balboa vibe almost to him, right?
Yeah, it was all a timing thing, really. I mean, in the UK at the time, the boxing was just going through this transition from, you know, a sport which had a couple of fights on every Saturday on prime time on sort of terrestrial television. So that period made names like Eubank and Ben and Frank Bruno and these guys, and they were household names, you know. And Collins, unfortunately, who was fighting at that weight and could have had this very lucrative career himself, was based in the States. So just as sort of the focus of boxing turns up in Europe, because that's where the money was and Sky Sports were, he finds himself out in Boston. And so he had to come back to Ireland to try and crash the party, really. And it was really tough because nobody really fancied sort of fighting him. And he did struggle for a while. But again, you know, the Balboa element of the story, I suppose, is he wasn't even supposed to get the Mill Street fight. You know, he came in as a late replacement for somebody else.
Yeah. And I mentioned in the intro Tony Quinn. Now, Tony Quinn has a lot of strings to his bow. Some people would say some of those strings are a little crooked, might be overstating it, but certainly not straight lines. A controversial fellow. But that notwithstanding, his mind training and his training of Steve Collins certainly seemed to help him and possibly secure his victory. Just give us a sense of what he did for him.
Well, I think it was to do with, I think the key kind of moment really for Collins is that he finds himself out in Las Vegas and he has no trainer, no backup team at all. He's essentially on his own over there. And he'd seen Tony Quinn on television, you know, as he was during those days. And he just thought, you know, what have I got to lose here? He just needed something. And, you know, whatever that something actually was, I think it largely depends on what your beliefs are in terms of what Tony Quinn does. But, you know, what can't be argued is that whatever that was kind of did two things. First of all, I think it certainly helped Steve Collins, but I it certainly unsettled Chris Eubank. And whether the latter was deliberate or not, I don't know. But whatever else happened, Quinn certainly had that effect on the two main protagonists.
Yeah. Now, Tony Quinn, in his defense, was a martial arts expert, but yet at the same time, it seemed to be the training Steve Collins was engaged in was largely mental as opposed to physical. And I was, despite knowing the outcome of the fight, I was watching the build up to the fight going, this guy needs to spend more time in the gym.
Yeah. I mean, it was certainly one of the more unconventional training sequences that that you could cut in a film. It was a gift as well. I remember the day that the footage came into the edit suite from an old cardboard box somewhere of, you know, Steve just basically throwing shapes in his room in Vegas, and suddenly out of the corner of the frame in walks Tony Quinn with a kind of an instruction manual, and you're thinking this must be a setup. You know, this has got to be, so you know, somebody who staged this. But you know, this was the training footage. You know, fact is often stranger than fiction, I suppose.
And listen, just on Tony Quinn and indeed Chris Eubank, like, you talk to everybody, including Steve Collins, obviously. But was Tony Quinn reluctant to talk to you?
No, I think, you know, he. I'm not the one who personally sets the interviews up, but I mean, I certainly talking to the producers, I got the sense that he was a very willing participant, much to my surprise, to be honest. I mean, I think certainly when we originally conceived this film, because you genuinely don't see much of Tony Quinn around.
No.
I certainly had not bargained for having him in the film as a first person witness. You know, I thought he'd be a character we'd be talking about, not talking to.
Yeah. So then Chris Eubank, I met him once on this very radio station you're talking to me on, and he really is, in my experience, the brief time I met him, just as you see him on TV, the way he is in person. He walked into a room and almost spoke to the entire room and kind of almost encouraged people to applaud his entry, like a fascinating kind of guy. But I was surprised that he sat down for your film, because, you know, it was a bad time for him. Like, you know, people know he lost the fight, and yet you really have to applaud the fact that he wanted to go through this again with you guys.
He was a great interviewee. You know, that was the morning I think our film changed, because, you know, there's an old cliche that, you know, history is written by the victors, and so you don't tend to get the perspective of defeat, really. And I don't know. I just think that maybe because it was such a novel experience that somebody actually wanted to talk to him about a fight that he lost, maybe that's what intrigued him enough to agree to do it in the first place, and why he sort of was so candid in the interview itself.
Yeah. And I suppose then finally, as I mentioned, look, it's no spoiler. Steve Collins wins the fight. But in terms of the documentary, I was right back there watching it. Like, it really helps your film, I guess, that the fight was such a good watch and you have most of the fight in it, albeit very edited. But I mean, the fact that it went the distance and, you know, it was down to the wire in some respects. I mean, you probably couldn't have made the movie if the fight itself hadn't been so damn good.
Oh, completely. You know, it all added to the sense of the occasion. I mean, what we wanted to do is to make a film about the event as opposed to a film about the fight. But having said that, if the fight wasn't very exciting, which it kind of was, and it had incidents within the fight itself that almost became sort of a microcosm of the story, you know, so all the stuff that had foreshadowed it, you know, the mind games and, you know, Collins' state of mind and Eubank's state of mind. And there are just incidents and plot points within the fight itself that sort of then reflected what you just watched or sat through for the previous hour. But yeah, you're right. The film itself, the fight itself was a gift.
Yeah. And then just finally, I suppose on the wider issue, like you have the great Paul Howard. I'm a big fan of his writing and indeed his talking. You know, he talked about being in the arena in Mill Street and all he could see were guards and Dublin gangland criminals. I mean, the movie is a very interesting snapshot of that time in Ireland, 95, like when we were, you know, turning from, it can get very cliched, but we were probably, you know, on the pinnacle of the start of the Celtic Tiger or something like that. I presume you're very cognizant of that this was a changing time in Ireland.
Oh, very much so. I mean, at the outset, you know, this was going to be kind of our Celtic Tiger movie. I mean, I was sort of a regular visitor to Ireland at the time. It was 2 or 3 years before I actually moved over. And I suppose as somebody who was just getting Ireland in snapshots of once every 2 or once every 3 months, the speed of the rate of change, the societal rate of change, the way just the landscape seemed to be changing. That I think was the key motivating factor for the film. It was, we just felt that the fight itself and Collins' story almost encapsulated Ireland's story at the time, you know, sort of this underdog nation that was on the cusp of becoming, for a brief period in time anyway, the richest country in Europe.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's fascinating stuff. One Night in Mill Street is in cinemas from April 5th. It is a delightfully compact 85 minutes, I think it is, just shy of 90 minutes. It rips along. I was talking to its director, Andrew Gallimore. Andrew, thanks a million.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew Gallimore there talking to me about One Night in Mill Street, a great documentary all about Steve Collins v. Chris Eubank and that famous, famous fight. Up next, performance psychologist Jerry Hussey on his favourite movie. Now you're listening to Screen Time News Talks TV and Movie Show. It's that stage of the week where we talk to a person in a note about their favourite movie. Jerry Hussey is one of Ireland's best known performance psychologists who's been working in the field of health and performance for almost 20 years and has led teams to success in high profile competitions from everything from the Olympic Games to World Cups. His latest book, The Freedom Within, became a bestseller, and he'll be talking about that book as part of the Dublin Book Festival on April 10th with Claire McKenna. More of that anon. I'm delighted to say he joins me now to chat about his favourite movie. Jerry, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. So listen, you did a nice thing. You came back with a favourite movie and I said, we had to ban that one. It's been chosen too many times, Back to the Future. But you kindly opted for your other favourite movie. So tell our listeners what it is and why.
Yeah, my other favourite movie, and in fairness, is probably his joint first with the one you didn't allow me to have. So I've no problem. And maybe it's no surprise given my line of work and my own background, but my movie I've chosen is A Beautiful Mind.
Oh, a fantastic movie. So just remind people what that's about. John Nash, the mathematician, genius but troubled.
Yeah, John Nash was a real-life character. He was a Nobel Prize winner and had a mind that was so expansive and so ingenious and at the same time was so troubled. And it depicts his character and his life and the brink and the small, I suppose, the tiny margin between genius and madman. And it really shows you that for him, the line between genius and madman disappears. So he's a guy that, you know, has experienced how amazing the human mind can be, but also the depths of it. So he hallucinates. He sees people that don't exist. He imagines scenarios that aren't there. And just when he has established himself as this incredible leader in his field, very quickly, as his mind unravels, people judge him, they criticize him, he becomes a laughing stock, and his mind brings him to probably, you know, lose everything he's worked for, and he has to rebuild himself. So I don't know if we're allowed to give away the end of the movie, but
I think we're okay. When it's favorite movie territory, you know, we'll caution advise. Here comes the spoiler, courtesy of Jerry Hussey, but fire ahead.
Yeah, so it shows you, and this is what I love about it, is that, you know, you can't give up on any human being, and you can't give up on a human mind. And sometimes we label and we judge and we leave people. But this guy managed to work his way back, and he managed to live. Not that he was cured of his mind challenges, but he learned to live with them, which is magnificent. And there's a final scene in the movie that I absolutely love. So his wife was the steadfast companion. She stuck with him even in his darkest, most crazy days, when he was, you know, doing stuff that was unbelievable, seeing things that weren't there, and the whole world had walked away. The wife never left him, and her steadfast love for him, her forgiveness, her just compassion was incredible. And she's actually the star of the whole story. But at the very end, when he's about to walk out to receive his prize, and he's, the world has fallen back in love with him, and now he's the hero again. Mm. There's a beautiful moment whereby he's about to walk out, and he's looking across into the corner. And his wife has now believed that he's been cured, if that's the word you want to use, for years.
Yeah.
And she realizes, as he's staring into empty space, that for him, it's not empty. It's full of all the characters that he's seen all his life. And she suddenly realizes that they're still with him, and he still sees them. And she looks at him and she says, "My God, John, you still see them?" And he said, "Of course. I just don't believe them anymore." And for me, for people living with anxiety or depression or PTSD or bereavement, the challenge in life isn't how do I get rid of this, because sometimes you don't get rid of it. But the question is, can I integrate this into my life into such a way that I still get to live a life?
Yeah.
And I love that story, that no mind is ever lost.
Yeah.
Every mind can find its way back with love, with support. And it doesn't mean that we can make your challenges go away, but we can absolutely make sure that you position them in such a place that there's still an incredible life to be lived.
Yeah, that's a beautiful description of the movie. Tell me this, you know, Russell Crowe, he's become so famous, and I suppose maybe there's baggage with him because, you know, he smashed telephones in hotel rooms and had his own problems and stuff, and is a larger than life character. And sometimes that's done maybe a disservice in the popular imagination to, at times, what a brilliant actor he is. And I presume you'd agree that he is brilliant as John Nash in this.
He's absolutely incredible. And for me, you know, whether it's a method acting technique or whether it's total immersion, or whether he knows pain. And I think that the greatest performances, particularly when they're portraying a person with pain, is someone who can relate to that. And in some ways, the character of John Nash probably gave Russell Crowe an opportunity to express himself. I think at times playing that character allowed the line between the character of John Nash and the real person of Russell Crowe, because whether we know it, like, I just think that in Russell, he finds it easy to play certain roles. And why is that? Either he's just an amazing actor, or it speaks to him. He feels at home. And I think in this movie, you can see that he wanted to embody this. He wanted this message to get out there. And he wanted people to say, even the most amazing people feel pain, and we can't judge them. And there's a reason he wanted to say that. So I often think the greatest performances come when the actor can connect with something that they're trying to express.
Yeah,
it was a way for Russell Crowe to send a statement to the world without Russell Crowe saying it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And of course, we should mention, you mentioned his wife's character, Jennifer Connelly, is brilliant as his wife as well. Well, listen, that is clearly your favourite movie. I'd love to know what you thought of Back to the Future, but unfortunately, I've banned it, so we'll never know, Jerry. Jerry, tell me this. We always ask non-actors and non-movie people in this slot, have they ever acted themselves? Did you ever grace a stage or a screen or anything like that?
No, I've never acted. But I'm fascinated with acting. I'm fascinated with taking a character from fiction and suddenly taking them to life. But I do get to go on stage, and I do get to, you know, regularly stand in front of 1,000, 2,000 people, and And what I do is I never have a script. I never have notes. And this is the truth, John, and anyone who knows me well will know this, or anybody that's come to my shows, is I walk out on stage for a six-hour show. I won't even know what my opening line is. And I allow something to come through me. So in order for me, I got to work with the crowd. So I have no point delivering a show if it's not really resonating with the audience. So I can resonate with a stage actor. And as I'm speaking, as I'm observing what's happening in the crowd, I'm observing the energy, and I can feel at one with the audience, and suddenly that allows me to know what to say. Yeah. Now, for some people, that would be the scariest thing in the world, to walk in front of 1,000 people, and you've promised them 6 hours of content, and you literally don't know the first line. But there's a trust that comes with that. And I've had to learn to know, like in the morning of an event, I have to go through certain routines to get my mind clear enough and my heart open enough so that I can work what's in that room. And I think all the greatest actors have that ability. So even though the director, the script writer can write in great detail what the character is, once the actor gets into the character, they start to say things and do things that nobody ever thought about. And it's like, how did that happen? And I think it's that immersion. So I'm fascinated with the world of acting. I'm fascinated with how they can bring a character to life. But my experience is being on stage in front of 1,000 people who are watching me for 6 hours. And I literally, from minute to minute, rarely know what's going to come next, because they tell me I'm not the show, they're the show. And everything I say has to resonate with them. So I'm watching and I'm feeling. And it's like the show is unfolding from me. And I don't know at times where it's coming from. But I just give myself the license and freedom to not think about it, but to feel it. And I think good acting is as much about the heart and the feel as it is about the brain.
Now, listen, talking of being on stage, you will be with Claire McKenna, my old mucker, on the 10th of April. She's of this parish, for the Dublin Book Festival, talking about your book, The Freedom Within. That book, as I alluded to in the introduction, has been highly successful. What's, you know, maybe you don't want to give away all the secrets, and people should show up to the event on April the 10th. But I mean, in a minute or two, why do you think that book has been so successful for you? And why have people responded to it in the way they have?
I think because with all my work, I try to work on the mind-body connection. And very often we think our thoughts and emotions haven't really a big impact in our life, or we think that they simply impact on our mood or our happiness. The book shows beyond doubt the science behind how every emotion you hold changes the chemistry of the body, the chemistry of the brain. Every emotion you hold has an impact on your organs and their health, and it has a massive impact on your gut health and your immune system. So I think what captured people's imagination is how powerful emotions are, that emotions have a physical impact on the body, and that emotions are not something that we're meant to serve. They're meant to serve us. Mm-hmm. And we think at times that our emotions are caused by what happens in the outside world. The book goes on to show that very often our emotions are caused simply by our response to what's happening in the outside world. And the book sets out to prove that emotions are really important, but there's no such thing as a negative or positive emotion. Every emotion is important information. And when we learn to deal with emotions, we can take the lesson out of the emotion, but then we can quickly get out of it. So I call that the emotional refractory phase. So we can quickly recognize when we're in an unhelpful emotion, and then we can quickly get out of that. So it's giving us a sense of emotional control back. So now, even in a world of uncertainty and adversity, we can feel calm, we can feel grateful, we can feel loving. It's giving people an empowered ability to regulate their own emotional self. And in doing that, we're regulating our chemistry, our immune system, and our physical health.
Fascinating. If you want to hear more about the book, The Freedom Within, Jerry will be in conversation with Claire McKenna as part of the Dublin Book Festival Spotlight Spring Series, and that's in the Town Hall on April 10th at 6 p.m. in the Windmill Quarter. We'll have to leave it there, Jerry. Lovely to talk to you. His joint favourite movie is undoubtedly A Beautiful Mind. Jerry Hussey, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The image of the Nobel is... Oh, I see. So you came here to find out if I was crazy.
Would I embarrass you?
Yes, it is possible. You see, I am crazy. I take the newer medications. But I still see things that are not here. I just choose not to acknowledge them. Like a diet of the mind, I choose not to indulge certain appetites.
A clip there from A Beautiful Mind. And that was the favourite movie of Jerry Hussey, and my thanks to him. That is it for this week. Next week on the show, I'm going to be talking to the star and the director of the new Amy Winehouse biopic of sorts, Back to Black, the lady who plays Amy Winehouse, Marissa Abile, and the director, Sam Taylor Johnson. So that is next week. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Enjoy the remainder of your weekend. Thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you next week.